in Sacramento, in that legislature there. And that ruling, of course, says that money cannot be regulated, spent in elections if it comes from so-called independent expenditure committees. And that ruling now has allowed an explosion of campaign cash into our political system. And finally, after that, came a string of rulings essentially weakening the federal bribery statute so that it's almost impossible to prosecute corruption and bribery, straight-up bribery. So the point being here is that people who are watching this understand that the system is dominated by money. I think what we unearth, again, through never-before-reported documents, is that it was a specific plan to deregulate the campaign finance system by people who knew they couldn't get their way on policy unless they were able to short-circuit democracy. To my mind, this is the real crisis of democracy, allowing our democracy to be bought.
And we just have 20 seconds. How is this election normalizing corruption, David?
Well, when you look at Donald Trump running out there saying to oil donors, I'll give me $1 billion and I will give you the policies that you want. When you see, to my mind, Democrats trying to avoid taking too many positions that might offend their corporate donors. When you see Democrats, big donors, demanding, for instance, they fire Lina Khan, and that none of that seeming like a scandal, all of it seeming like that's just the way politics is done. We are in an era where that kind of corruption is now normal.
We have to leave it there. David Sirota, editor-in-chief of The Lever, the podcast series Master Plan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
The leaves are falling, the birds are chirping, and KBOO's Fall Membership Drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at kboo.fm/give between now and September 21st and support independent airwaves.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, a new police accountability system in Portland clears another legal hurdle.
Grants Pass doesn't provide basic humanitarian services for homeless residents forced into campsites.
And Oregon's recent measles outbreak ranks second worst in the nation.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 30th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Reed Johnson. On Thursday morning, Portland cleared a major hurdle in advancing its proposal for a new system of police oversight and accountability at a hearing before a federal judge in downtown Portland. That's despite significant community misgivings. KBOO reporters Jasmine Moss and Sam Bowman were there and have this to report.
The city of Portland's long path towards a new police oversight system approved by voters in 2020 passed a major landmark yesterday. A controversial code package put forward by the city was the subject of a hearing in federal court before Judge Michael Simon. In the end, Simon's ruling amounted to a compromise that no party is likely to be completely happy with. Before the court was the question of whether the proposed code for the creation of the new oversight system fairly, reasonably, and adequately met the requirements of the settlement agreement between the City of Portland and the U.S. Department of Justice. The city's oversight proposal is a drastically scaled back and altered version of the one put together by the All-Volunteer Police Accountability Commission, or PAC. The altered proposal has prompted persistent criticism from many former members of the PAC and other advocates for strong police oversight. The city has stated that much of what it removed from the PAC's proposal could be voted on by the future oversight board once it is seated, including the new board's jurisdiction over misconduct cases. The city, the DOJ, and the police union were all in agreement yesterday before Judge Simon that the code package should be implemented as is, but community members and advocates voiced significant concerns related to training, board membership, and jurisdiction. Some of these concerns were shared by Judge Simon, who opened the hearing by outlining several areas of concern with the city's proposal. He asked the parties to explain why they felt it necessary for board members to participate in police ride-alongs and the Bureau's Community Academy, saying, quote, "There are some people whose contributions might be very valuable on this committee who have had certain experiences and trigger points that make it very burdensome, difficult, perhaps even impossible for them to comfortably participate in a police ride-along," end quote. Simon also questioned how the city would go about enforcing its prohibition on board membership for people with a, quote, "objective demonstration of bias for or against the police, especially if there's a disagreement. This process is not spelled out in the code language." Ultimately, the court tasked the new independent monitor with overseeing this and other potential areas of dispute.
These concerns share a common theme in the community complaints about the city's edited code package, namely that the package will exclude many members whose lived experience with policing would be valuable and insert police influence into what was intended to be an independent, community-led accountability system. Perhaps the most glaring example of this shift in police influence is the city's creation of a 10-member committee that will be responsible for nominating all members of the community board. The committee was not in the charter language, nor in the PAC proposal, and 3 of the 10 seats are set aside for police appointees, with another 4 from city council. Given the current city council makeup, it seemed likely at least 6 of the 10 seats, or a voting majority, on the nominating committee would be occupied by people with a pro-police bias. The city's argument yesterday was that it is important to allow police to have a say in some piece of the process, since the charter specifically excludes law enforcement from membership in the board. In the end, after a long day of back and forth, Judge Simon allowed the code package to go forward as written, but with the condition that it would not go into effect until after the new city government was in place in January of 2025. This means the current city council will not be appointing members of the nominating committee, nor will whomever becomes Portland's next mayor. KABU reached out to the city and the DOJ, as well as some of the community witnesses, but did not receive response before airtime. The city has an item on next week's council agenda to approve the code package, and all parties will meet before Judge Simon for a status conference on January 7th of 2025. For KABU News, I'm Jasmine Moss.
And I'm Sam Bowman.
Since this story was recorded, Mayor Ted Wheeler has released a statement expressing displeasure with Judge Simon's decision, calling it, quote, "driven by politics." The mayor compared the decision to Senate Republicans' blocking of President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court in 2016. Wheeler characterized Simon's decision as being in response to concerns raised by former City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty during the hearing itself, though Hardesty's concerns have been stated by multiple other community members and advocacy groups since the city's proposal was released last year. Current City Commissioner Rene Gonzalez, who defeated Hardesty in the 2022 election and is currently running for mayor, called the ruling, quote, "textbook judicial overreach" in a tweet this afternoon. Joanne Hardesty also sent a statement to KABU calling Simon's ruling a, quote, "great outcome," and agreeing that the next city council, quote, should have the responsibility of appointing people they believe will make an impact, end quote. Homeless advocates in Grants Pass, Oregon, say the city is failing to meet basic humanitarian standards in its new sanctioned campsites for homeless residents. Homeless residents were first cleared from public parks and put into a sanctioned encampment 6 days ago. It's a concrete and gravel lot with some patches of dried grass. More important is what it doesn't have: shade, water, or any method for cooking food. 2 days after ushering people into the camps, the city closed the gate to the fenced-in site. Advocates told Street Roots that the gate, which has a number of padlocks, makes homeless residents feel trapped inside. It's also gotten in the way of work from local nonprofits who provide medical care to homeless Grants Pass residents. They're the ones providing water and shade to these residents, but the city has stood firm on not allowing donations at the campsite. Cassie Leach is the co-founder of the Mobile Interactive Navigation Team. Leach says some people forced into the site have already been hospitalized due to heat exposure. Labor Day weekend is forecasted to reach the low triple digits in Grants Pass. Homeless residents are required to move frequently under a new city ordinance. Every week, they'll be compelled to move between the two sanctioned camping sites that are open so far, with 72 hours prior notice. City Manager Aaron Kubik says there's no legal obligation for the city to provide more than a place for people to stay. Some city councilors worried any extra sites or services they approve now could mean they're on the hook to provide them long term.
And across the state, Oregon is experiencing its largest outbreak of measles since 1991. There have been 30 reported cases since mid-June. That means 2024 has already exceeded the state's 2019 outbreak, when 28 cases were reported. The outbreak is concentrated in Marion County, where 20 cases have been reported. Additional cases have been found in Clackamas and Multnomah counties. All cases involve unvaccinated individuals. So far, two people have been hospitalized. Paul Cieslak is the medical director for communicable diseases and immunizations in Oregon Health Authority's Public Health Division. He spoke following the announcement of two new cases, saying, quote, "The disease is among the most contagious known, and the only way we know to stop it is to maintain very high immunization rates, upwards of 95%. Two doses of the vaccine provide lifelong protection for about 97% of recipients," end quote. According to Cieslak, Oregon lacks the immunization rates necessary to halt the outbreak. Since 2000, non-medical exemptions for immunizations among Oregon kindergartners has risen from 1% to 8.8%. In Marion County, the center of the recent outbreak, 96% of kindergartners were up to date with their measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine as of last year. Health officials note that transmission occurs in pockets of unvaccinated people and that concerned parents should check their school's immunization reports. They say 95% immunization is needed to reach herd immunity and stop the spread of measles. Across the United States, cases of measles are on the rise. Oregon's outbreak is the second largest in the country behind Illinois, which has 67 reported cases. Nationwide, 87% of cases involve individuals who were unvaccinated or whose vaccination status was unknown.
Eligible Oregon families have until Monday to apply for summer food benefits. The summer EBT program provides families with a one-time payment of $120 per child in a household. The program was started during the pandemic and made permanent this year. Most who qualified automatically received benefits. David Wieland with Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon says one in six children in the state face food insecurity.
We know that that spikes in the summer when access to school meals is interrupted. Summer EBT is the most direct way of addressing that summer hunger. It lets families access food that's nourishing and appropriate for their families.
Wieland says the state has already distributed $40 million in benefits to 330,000 children this summer. Families can check their eligibility for the program at sebt.oregon.gov. Wieland says people in Oregon and across the country are feeling pressure from increased food costs. He says summer EBT is particularly appreciated by families because they can get the food they want with it.
A lot of families have noted that summer EBT sort of allows them some choice of what they get to feed their children during the summer, some choice in providing the nutritious and culturally specific food that their children deserve.
The state's website for the program notes that people's immigration status won't be asked for or considered in determining eligibility for summer EBT. Most eligibility requirements are tied to children at schools with the National School Lunch Program and households that qualify for benefits like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or temporary assistance for needy families.
Oregon's worst wildfire season on record also continues. Currently, over 1.4 million acres have burned across the state, surpassing the record set in 2020. Colder temperatures over the last few weeks have meant progress in fighting the largest fires raging across the state. The Crazy Creek Fire east of Paulina in Cook County is currently at 93% containment. It's burned over 86,000 acres since it began on July 22nd. The Monkey Creek Fire is currently the largest fire still active. It's burned over 178,000 acres in Morrill County and is 48% contained. Fire officials are warning the public that the fire danger is high as Oregon enters its holiday weekend. Labor Day weekend was the stage for a series of megafires in 2020, which burned more than 1 million acres in a matter of days. While lightning has been the predominant case of fires this year, officials hope to avoid human-caused wildfires. Stage 2 public use fire restrictions are still in effect across Central Oregon. Those ban open fires on all public lands.
Vice President Harris says she'd consider a bipartisan cabinet should she win in November. Louisiana is the latest state to push the false claim of non-citizen voters, and incidents of swatting contribute to an increasingly toxic political culture. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I think it's important to have people at the table when some of the most important decisions are being made that have different views, different experiences. And I think it would be to the benefit of the American public to have a member of my cabinet who was a Republican.
Vice President Kamala Harris tells CNN she'd consider a bipartisan cabinet if she wins. In her first extended interview since nomination, Harris said she has shifted some on fracking and immigration, but her values haven't changed, pointing to record funding for clean energy and her own prosecution of gangs and cross-border trafficking. Republicans criticized Harris for doing the interview along with VP pick Tim Walz. Louisiana is the latest red state acting to stop non-citizens from voting in federal elections, even though it's already illegal and almost never happens. Governor Jeff Landry says fewer than 50 non-citizens have been taken off the rolls over 2 years, and there's no evidence any actually voted. But he says state agencies that provide voter registration forms must now include a disclaimer warning non-citizens of prosecution.
Every time an illegal alien votes, it cancels out a vote from a citizen.
The Justice Department is charging 2 Eastern European men with swatting dozens of public figures. Former Wisconsin Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher says he resigned at risk to a GOP's thin majority after a bogus 911 call claimed his family was being held hostage at gunpoint.
I signed up for the death threats and the late night swatting, but they did not. And for a young family, I would say this job is really hard.
The North Carolina Board of Elections is refusing to take Robert F. Kennedy Jr. off the ballot now that he's stopped campaigning to support former President Donald Trump. Kennedy's name will also stay on ballots in Michigan and Wisconsin. A new poll from AARP calls the Senate race in Maryland a dead heat. Popular former Republican governor and Trump critic Larry Hogan is tied with Democrat and Prince George's County executive Angela Alsobrooks. Previous polls in the reliably blue state showed Alsobrooks ahead, but Jeff List with Impact Research says Hogan's name recognition is helping him.
Part of the reason that Larry Hogan is right now doing as well as he is with a lot of Democratic-leaning constituencies is that younger voters know Larry Hogan a lot better than they know Alsobrooks.
In Ohio, efforts are underway to mobilize unmarried women Senator J.D. Vance once labeled as childless cat ladies. Celinda Lake with Lake Research says despite single women's traditionally low turnout, health care and consumer issues could change that.
Having someone fight for them, get price gouging down, fight for lower prescription drug prices, the insulin issue, and the price of insulin is very salient in Ohio.
Highlighting the importance of reproductive care in the race, Trump now says in vitro fertilization should be paid for by the government. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to a Fall Membership Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. We'd like to remind you, you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 58 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, bright and sunny with a high of 95. Today in history, in 1909, the Burgess Shale fossils were discovered in the Canadian Rockies by Charles Doolittle Walcott, who succeeded in not living up to his middle name. The fossils were some of the first discovered that preserved the small parts, the soft parts of the creatures who are fossilized there. The quote of the day is from English novelist Mary Shelley, born this day in 1797. She said, quote, "We are unfashioned creatures, but half made up, if one wiser, better, dearer than ourselves, such a dear friend ought to be. Do not lend his aid to perfectionate our weak and faulty natures."
Native leaders asked California Governor Gavin Newsom to sign a law that would allow tribes to have co-stewardship agreements with the government over their ancestral lands and waters. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native leaders are asking California Governor Gavin Newsom to sign a bill that would allow federally recognized tribes to sign agreements with the state to co-manage and co-govern ancestral lands and waters. Assembly Bill 1284 unanimously passed both houses in the state legislature this week. Scott Sullivan is vice chairman of the Talawa Dene Nation.
This is going to allow us to deepen our relationship in a government-to-government level. It'll give us better access to our traditional ancestral territories, to improve the environment, and to reconnect our people to the land.
Fawn Murphy chairs the Puliklet tribe of Yurok people and says tribes want to promote biodiversity and reverse erosion and environmental degradation.
As these devastating climate impacts are coming and things are changing so rapidly, we need to bring it back to what works. California tribal people have been practicing traditional ecological knowledge since time immemorial.
The bill is also intended to help California meet its goal of preserving 30% of the state's land and waters by 2030. Democratic members of Congress, governors, and mayors appealed to Native Americans at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago last week. Elected leaders stopped by two Native American caucus meetings, delivering remarks, hoping to energize attendees, asking them to rally their communities to vote and back the Democratic Party. New Mexico Congresswoman Teresa Leger Fernandez says the Native American vote is key.
We cannot deliver the kinds of investments and respect for Indian country if we do not win the presidency, if we do not flip the House, and we do not keep the Senate. And you know what? The Native vote is going to be key in Arizona, Wisconsin, Montana to make sure we keep that great senator up there over and over. This election turns on the indigenous vote.
New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham in remarks told the Native caucus there have been many accomplishments in Indian country, but there's still much work to do, including electing the Democratic presidential ticket.
I am clear that when we remind your and our communities what's at stake and what we're building for our children and their future, and that the values that you have always demonstrated in Healthier ought to be the values for all across America.
Regina Romero, mayor of Tucson, Arizona, says the Native vote has made a difference in the state in the past and is important this year.
We've got to make sure, one, that the platform that the Democratic Party has carried is a pro-Native American platform.
Governor Stephen Ro Lewis of the Gila River Indian Community in Arizona says he's encouraging people to vote, but the tribe is not officially endorsing candidates. In her role as vice president, Kamala Harris visited the Gila River Indian community, and as a presidential candidate, she included Governor Lewis in a rally, which he says makes a difference to Native voters.
I know the Gila River Indian community, you know, and I know as us as indigenous people and tribal people,
when those types of leaders, when they come to Indian country, and especially as our elders told us, that means so much. For them, it's not about on social media, or it's not about, on TV, a political ad. It's about coming on our traditional land, face to face.
Democrats say the Harris-Walz ticket understands issues in Indian country and would bring that to the White House. Some tribal leaders at the DNC say they also had representatives at the Republican National Convention and are listening to both parties while advocating for tribal issues. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Election Day is a little more than 2 months away. Voters who find themselves turned off by the political environment are urged to consider their long-term health as possible motivation to re-engage with the voting process. Over the past few years, organizations such as the American Medical Association have emphasized messaging that voting is a social determinant of health. North Dakota professor Craig Burns specializes in social work and says this is especially true for marginalized populations. For example, he says a candidate's stance on local zoning laws and key services might resonate with a person's need to establish a better quality of life.
Whether people have access to an affordable grocery store that sells healthy produce, or whether they have access to safe transportation.
Combined with more commonly discussed issues such as jobs, Burns says all of these factors play a role in shaping health outcomes. He adds that if people feel like their voice doesn't matter, they should know that local races, including legislative seats, are sometimes decided by just a few votes. For those who need guidance in researching candidate platforms, Burns says reaching out to the campaign staff for answers is an option.
And always let the candidate know you're a voter in their district, and that'll kind of perk up their ears a little bit.
Burns, who has helped lead regional civic engagement efforts in past elections, says how a candidate views environmental regulations is another topic worth exploring. He points to the tainted water scandal in Flint, Michigan from a decade ago as an example. Researchers say the crisis stemmed from state and federal policy failures.
Big Pharma is impacting the ability of community health centers to deliver care to patients. Drug makers have increasingly denied discounted medicines to safety net community health centers, a resource that allowed centers to expand access to care. Eric Galatas has more.
As Congress heads back to work after the August recess, advocates for the nation's safety net community health centers are urging lawmakers to end Big Pharma's roadblock on discounted medicines through a program known as 340B. Pueblo Community Health Center CEO Donald Moore says by denying discounts, drug companies are withholding critical resources that help centers serve a growing number of patients who can't afford to pay.
That $1.5 million now is staying in their pockets. It's not going into my organization's charitable mission to provide access to care.
The roadblock comes as more Coloradans who have been dropped from Medicaid coverage turn to centers that serve all patients regardless of their ability to pay. Drug makers have claimed that discounted medicines are being diverted to patients not eligible under 340B or that savings aren't being used to expand access to health care. Justin Hannell is the pharmacy director for Valleywide Health Systems, which serves southern Colorado. He says even with discounts, drug prices have gone up by 200% over the past 5 years. He emphasizes that all patients filling Valleywide prescriptions are eligible under 340B, even if they get them at their contracted pharmacies that make it easier for people living in remote areas to access medicines.
The intent was so that it would enable entities like ourselves to stretch scarce federal resources as far as possible and reach more eligible patients and provide more services.
Moore points to a third-party audit that shows his center is in full compliance with 340B, but he says no one has asked to see his books. He says denying discounts nationwide will ultimately end up hurting patients and taxpayers if people with chronic conditions such as diabetes, hypertension, or depression can't access medicines.
Someone who doesn't have access to the medicines they need to control chronic conditions is at greater risk of going to the ER, being admitted to the hospital, and having complications associated with that.
This is Eric Galatas for the Colorado News Connect.
The conservative roadmap to reshape the federal government, Project 2025, calls for a dramatic expansion in offshore oil drilling and the privatization of government agencies overseeing ocean health. Critics say the policy shift could be catastrophic for all coastal communities whose residents depend on a healthy ocean. Catherine Carley reports from New Hampshire.
Critics of the conservative plan to expand offshore oil drilling say it endangers coastal communities who rely on a healthy ocean. Project 2025, written by the right-leaning Heritage Foundation, aims to dramatically reshape U.S. energy policy, opening millions of acres to new oil and gas production. Angelo Villa-Gomez with the Center for American Progress says it prioritizes short-term profits over long-term climate sustainability.
It's going to prohibit the United States from even including the word climate change in any of our government documents. You can't deal with these real threats just by closing your eyes and pretending that it's not there.
While offshore drilling is illegal in New Hampshire, Villa-Gomez says operations elsewhere spread toxins far and wide, harming marine life and vital habitats. Supporters of the plan say offshore drilling releases fewer emissions and gets America closer to being energy independent. Project 2025 also promotes the dismantling and privatization of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The federal agency handles the vast majority of climate, weather, and marine science research, as well as commercial fishing regulations. Villa-Gomez says breaking up the agency could lead to chaos on the water and economic instability for vital industries throughout New England.
NOAA manages all of our fisheries. So are we going to let all of the states have different rules for how we manage fisheries?
Former President Donald Trump has claimed he has no knowledge of Project 2025. However, many parts of the plan were written by members of his former administration. The plan would undo much of President Joe Biden's executive order to protect at least 30% of American land and ocean areas by 2030. For New Hampshire News Connection, I'm Catherine Carley.